You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
This is the third week, and it's completely unpredictable what happened. Like, my kids got it, and there was no symptoms. My friends got it, there was no symptoms. Robin spent 5 days in the hospital. I've been like, I'm better than I was at my worst. At my worst, I would have killed myself if someone gave me a gun. Yeah. How are you, Brandon? I haven't talked to you in forever. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Yeah, I'm in Portugal right now. I've been kind of gallivanting around Europe with my vaccine.
Oh, because you could travel anywhere with the vaccine passport, right?
It's like the golden ticket. Yeah, it just opens up everything.
I did not get vaccinated, but everybody then thinks, like the first question people ask when they, because I posted on Instagram, I had COVID. And the first question, nobody asked like, hey, how you doing? People asked, you said, you know, be better and stuff. But, you know, most people said, did you get vaccinated? And if I said, right. I didn't say
polarization.
Anything. Yeah. I didn't say anything, but that assumed that no. And then they assumed, okay, well, you must be a racist then. Or
anti-vaxxer.
Where were you
racist.
January 6th? Like, And it's as if it's interesting the level people think that most of our decisions are rational and based on a philosophy and are thought out. Like, I was simply lazy. I spend all day in my office. I don't really see people that much. I've been exposed to COVID a billion times and I never got it. So I was just lazy and I didn't get it.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
I wasn't a racist.
Yeah. America is a funny place these days.
So what is traveling around Europe giving you a perspective on America? Like, what's, we're going to talk about your book, of course, which is excellent. It's the Navy Jack Reacher. Tell me what's been going on in your life.
I mean, I sold Crate Club in the pandemic, my e-commerce business.
Good or bad? Was it a good deal?
Yeah. I mean, look, it was a nice seven-figure deal. I didn't pay any tax on the transaction, so I'm happy. I needed to sell. Like, the business was in trouble. Our supply chain got hit, so I sold to a competitor. So a big monkey off my back, and I got a nice exit. So I'm running SoftRep and maybe turn it over to my COO to run at the end of the year, and then I'm maybe do something else. If this series takes off, because we sold Steel Fear to Peacock, which is NBC Universal's streaming network. If that turns into a bigger franchise, maybe that's something I lean into and just do that. But I'm tossing around a few startup ideas as well.
Can you say any of the startup ideas?
Yeah. So my two front runners right now is I own hotlaces.com. So I was thinking about branding shoelaces the same way that Beats branded headphones and Stance did for socks. But imagine like super high-end, like LeBron shoelace or Lady Gaga shoelace. So that's kind of an idea.
And you know what's trending, by the way? We did a podcast about this, vegan tennis shoes or vegan sneakers. So if it's like organic materials, but still the cool look, that's like the hot thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing totally different is I have this idea to make essentially a pocket therapist. So imagine like that movie Her, but you have an AI based, like take the best minds in psychology and teach the AI to respond to the FAQ, right? And then it just gets smarter and smarter, and you have this little pocket therapist. Because mental health is big these days.
I love it. But if you use something like GPT-3, you can't teach it with a knowledge base that large is the problem.
Yeah, I don't know how it would work yet, but it was just it's an idea that's floating around my head. Because
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you about that one. I have some interest in that area, both on the online therapy side and the AI side.
I would love to talk to you about it because as you know, not all therapists are created equally.
Believe me, I know.
Yeah, same with me. So I think, you know, having a AI-based resource like that would be pretty powerful.
And in general, things okay? Like your life good, everything?
Yeah, life is pretty damn good. My kids are doing great. Hunter finished his first year at St. Andrews. He's a machine learning psychology major in Scotland. He's doing a crypto startup with his buddies. Other son and daughter doing great. I fell in love with some woman in Capri, Italy, this over in Europe. So it's like a new thing, which is kind of cool.
And she's traveling with you?
She came from Zurich to stay with me in Libsyn. She's out at the getting her hair done right now. We're having a fancy dinner tonight.
So, Brandon, you just came out with the novel, Steel Fear. You and co-author John David Mann.
Yep.
And Brandon, you're getting to the point where you're almost writing as many books as me. So you have Steel Fear, The Red Circle, The Making of a Navy SEAL, The Killing School. Most of these are nonfiction. Steel Fear is your first like novel. The Red Circle, The Making of a Navy SEAL, The Killing School, which talks about your experiences teaching the sniper school for the Navy SEALs, Mastering Fear, A Navy SEAL's Guide.
That Mastering Fear was Kamal told me to write that book when I taught him how to swim in New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. You taught him how to swim. He was terrified of swimming. There's lots of things in life that are... for some people are easy, but for some people, for whatever reason, it triggers something really deep in them and they're terrified about it. And of course, in the field of battle, you're going to find out about yourself in a pretty harsh way right when you don't want to find out about yourself. And so Mastering Fear, you need to know how to do it before you're afraid of something. And it was an excellent book. We did a podcast about it. Since podcast number one, you've been telling me you want to write a novel. You've been telling me you want to write a novel specifically about an experience you had on, a Navy ship. You told me how you were going to write the novel. How come you didn't call me before this novel came out? I had to just see it on Amazon.
You know what? I think it's because of all the shit that's going on in the world. I
I got it done, and then I was like, oh God, I gotta like reach out to my friends and tell them about the book. So, and a novel is very different promotional.
Yes. I rarely have novelists on.
Yeah. Which the cool thing is the novel is based off a lot of true events. And I think maybe you agree, like you could teach a leadership course off this book based on the bad leadership of the aircraft carrier Captain Eagleburg.
Not only the bad leadership of the captain, but Finn, and again, Finn is kind of like those Jack Reacher style characters. Like, he's got his own code of values. He's a little bit of a dark horse. You don't really know what he's thinking or feeling. He's had these experiences that I won't get into, but he's had these experiences that have really developed his character and his code of values. And he's very observational. So he looks at people and decides if they... And I might be describing it wrong, but he kind of looks to see if they share his code of values. And if not, then how it's different. And then he uses that to assess how he's going to act them. He's almost a little bit more thoughtful than Jack Reacher, I would say. You know, Jack Reacher is a famous Lee Child character that is that kind of ex-military big guy who wanders into problems, like Finn does here on the ship. But But yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned. That's why I think this would be a great character, a great TV character. But what I'm excited about too is, you know, you're not a novelist, but you wrote basically a best-selling novel that now you're selling the option of film rights to NBC and TV show rights and all this stuff. And let's talk process first. Like, someone's listening to this saying, well, I'm not a writer. I can't write a novel. How did you write this? And congratulations, because it's an excellent book. It's a page turner, and you do my favorite thing, which I think every novelist should learn from: short chapters. Damn it, you guys with MFAs, you got your goddamn master's degree and you think you know how to write, and you write these 30 page chapters about someone's flashback to when their mother beat them, and we don't give a shit, and I gotta wait 30 pages, and then there's no cliffhanger at the end. We just go back to reality, present day. Like, short chapters, cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. If you don't do anything else, just do that, and you'll write a good book. Okay, sorry, Brandon, go ahead.
No, it's all true. And all stuff I had to learn, especially character development. I was in a private talk with Alan Loeb on Clubhouse, and we were talking character development. You just can't get lazy on character development. You got to give them a thing. You got to make them interesting.
Well, actually, let's talk about this, because I'm going to take notes. I always consider writing to be, there's no such skill as, oh, I am a good writer. Like, there are a lot of micro skills. So one micro skill is plotting. Another micro skill is characterization. Another micro skill is world building. You have to kind of like flesh out the world that your character exists in. Obviously, another micro skill is dialogue. That's very important. Another micro skill is understanding what perspective you're going to use. Is it first person, second person, third person, third person omniscient? You know, these are all the, you know, and there's a bunch more. There's also your use of language. There's cliffhangers. There are micro skills to the micro skills. But okay, let's talk about what you learned.
So what I would say character development is you can't get lazy and just kind of plug a hole with a name and be vague about a character in the book, because even if they have a small role, you still have to like put in the work and build out the character and do it in a way that's not going to drone on. Like you said earlier, nobody wants to read a, you know, massive chapter just on one person's, you know, life story. But on the process side, I started writing this book and I got about 20,000 words in, and it was extremely tough because first novel, I can write nonfiction all day long, but inventing the story, which even though it was based on real events. So when I was, before I was a Navy SEAL, I was stationed on board the Abraham Lincoln, where Steel Fear takes place, as a rescue swimmer helicopter crewman. We had a sexual predator on the boat. He assaulted 6-7 women. They never caught the guy. And it gave me this idea for this serial killer. And so years later, I read Stephen King's On Writing. I watched a couple of the masterclass authors, and
which ones?
And I, you know what, I have. I'm as soon as I said it, I was like,
James
shit,
Patterson's got a good one.
No, Patterson. I watched Patterson, and there was another woman. I forget her name, but the process of writing fiction is very different. So then I started getting up in New York, writing at 5 a.m. and just boom, writing. Like Stephen King said, just put your ass in the seat and start writing. And the characters were kind of coming to life because that's my style. Then I got to a point where I'm running this e-commerce business and my media company and finishing nonfiction books. And I called up John and I said, who's also a prolific nonfiction writer. And I said, do you want to collaborate on this? Because John, to your point about the different micro skill sets, John and I have very complementary skill sets. I'm detail oriented. I am very good at plot. John is incredible at character development, world building. I'm good at dialogue. John's good at dialogue. So we have these overlaps, and then we kind of fill in on strength and weakness. Like I wrote most of the murder scenes, and I'm writing the fight scenes right now for book two, which is Cold Fear. Takes place in Iceland. But it's very fun, but it's a lot of work. And it's not like a nonfiction book where you can just sell the concept to a publisher off a one-page proposal. You have to finish the damn thing. And
right, like a novel is this almost the stupidest activity one can do, which is you have to write the entire thing yeah. before you know if you're going to even one person wants to read it. You might.
Yeah.
In the 90s, when I was just learning my own set of skills for writing, I wrote 4 novels and about 50 short stories. All were horrible because you have to get through that phase too.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Like you have, like you said, you have to sit down and there's a billion books out there. It's very competitive. You're not just writing it for art. You're writing it because you're competing with every other. Someone's either going to read your book or another. They're not going to read 2 books at the same time. So it's a difficult skill, and it gets harder all the time. And I want to add, you wrote a genre book. Like we've referred to James Patterson and Lee Child. These are genre writers, very specific type of genre. You wrote a thriller. And people sometimes have a bad feeling about thrillers, but I find, or not thrillers, genre books in general, but I find genre books to be just as literary as any other book if they're good. It's just that the language might be a little simpler, and that's fine because it's not about the language.
Yeah, we do cross into kind of, and it's kind of like a blend of if Tom Clancy and Agatha Christie had a baby, this is what the book is, because it is cross genre a little bit. But yeah, I agree with you. And look, I wrote a blog about, I read this New York Times review on John Mayer's new album. I'm a big John Mayer fan. And this guy was ripping him to shreds because it wasn't this like revolutionary piece of work. I'm like, it's simple. I like simple. It's why I love Steinbeck. It's like, keep it simple. It makes you feel good. And sometimes that's okay.
I don't know if you've heard of something called the Fisher Kincaid score. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
So what it is it's a score that you feed it, like there's Fisher Kincaid calculators on the web, and you feed it an article or a book or a story, and it will tell you at what grade level the article was written or the book was written. So for instance, I fed in Old Man in the Sea, the book, which arguably, you know, clinched, was the tipping point for Ernest Hemingway winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. And if I remember correctly, that was written at a 4th grade level. And yeah, people don't realize the best literature out there is readable. You got to read it. And then one time I was working with an entrepreneur and he was showing me his business summary and I put it into the Fisher Kincaid calculator. It came out at an 18th grade level. And I'm like, man, I can't understand this. And I went to graduate school. I can't understand this. And so some people want to act smart, but you have to take that impulse away. You have to write simply, like you said, and this book is very readable.
Thanks. Yeah, and probably the biggest challenge for John and I was describing this complex aircraft carrier environment, which is 3 Empire State Buildings next to each other. That's how big the ship is. It's a floating city. Yeah, it's a floating city.
How many people work on it?
I think close to 6,000. And true story, we mentioned this in the book, there was a time where two brothers were stationed on the same aircraft carrier for 6 months and never saw each other while the ship was at sea. It was just like so big. They never ran into each other.
That happens even with me and my kids in the same house.
Yeah.
Not that the house is so big as I just stay here to a podcast. Tell me about plotting, because obviously to plot a thriller is difficult. Like, there's a handful of people in the world who could do it. And you guys, I was impressed. Like, you guys did a really good job. So what is plotting? What was your process here? How do you write a thriller? What's the difference between a thriller and like a mystery?
Well, I mean, this has a lot of mystery to it, right? It's kind of a locked room mystery.
That's why it's cross genre.
Yeah, that's exactly. So, you know, the important thing was, okay, how do we build this environment, this world of the aircraft carrier? The main plot being there's this killer on the loose and nobody knows who it is, and there's multiple suspects. I mean, even the hero, which I'll try not to give any spoilers, but Finn is the hero. He even thinks it's himself because he has these memory lapses, right? So right up to the end, I think we do a really good job kind of pointing the finger at multiple suspects.
Can I ask you a question? And I'm sorry to interrupt. So would you say that's a consequence? Obviously, this happens a lot in thrillers and mysteries. Let's just say they're one big genre that you know, like, I'm just thinking even back to Scooby-Doo. You always think it's one guy, and it turns out to be Mr. Jenkins all along, like the nice guy you never would have suspected. And I like how in this one, even the main character is not 100% sure it isn't him. Like, that was, exactly. You always want to find, I always describe it like a phone. The iPhone is 99.999% like every other phone built since 1957. But it also now has music and movies and games and apps and stuff like that. So you keep the structure, but then there's the famous Steve Jobs, and there's one more thing. So it's like you keep the structure as much as you can, but then you add one more thing. So people who are proficient in reading the genre say, oh, this is new. I want to see how this turns out.
Yeah. And so that was like the original plot mountain was this, you know, how this hero's journey to catch the killer and that happening. And then to build more tension, you know, we wanted to make this situation where the aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, there's a situation with Iran happening. So then you have this like outside tension building and then the captain and the careerism, he's like, okay, I'm trying to like keep this hidden so I can deal with it internally because I don't want it to get out to the bigger Department of Defense because he's worried about his career and all this other stuff happening with Iran. And quick sidebar, I was blown away so we sold the rights to Peacock, and Ben Smith is producing the TV series. He did all the Jason Bourne movies.
Oh my gosh, I love those.
I do too. The studio was like, you guys have to replace Iran. It's kind of over. Middle East is worn out. And I was like, okay, well, we'll just sub in China. Like, that's an easy one. Oh, we can't touch China. Ben was like, nobody can touch China in Hollywood. They have too much money on the table. Like, crazy shit. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, the NBA is screwed because like one basketball player stood up for what he believed in. And now basketball can't be seen in China.
It's crazy. Yeah. Which I don't think I know one of my I'm in the Young Presidents organization. One of my friends is involved in the NBA. He said that a typical like LeBron Lakers game on a Thursday, Friday night will draw, you know, like say 1 to 2 million. The next morning in China, it's like 9 million viewers. So it's a big thing. Like, it's basketball in China is massive, but they have so much leverage. It's just, it's a little bit, you know, it used to be you couldn't do anything like bad against the Jewish community. Now it's China, you know, in Hollywood. It's just kind of crazy the way
so
it works.
Funny. But plotting though seems like, how do you do it? How do you say that there's multiple suspects without people saying, I know what he's doing. He's just trying to show us. It's not really this guy. He's trying to make us think it's this guy. Like, it seems easy to fall into that trap.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, you have to have very interesting, believable character development. And I think we do that. And then you kind of, you know who it is, at least we did. We knew who it was all along. So it's, you know, it just worked out. Like, I don't know how to explain it. And a lot of it, you know, I would say I did the plot development, that I got the story going. John, I had the serial killer because it was based off of my real experience. John did a great job with Finn, like developing the character Finn, which I think is super interesting. And thanks to John, we now have a series because, you know, Finn lives on. Yeah, we're already about to finish book two.
How deep did you go into backstory with Finn when you were developing the character? Like, and when I say you, I'm referring to both of you guys.
Yeah.
Was there stuff in the backstory that you had written down that never made it into the book but could appear in future books?
Yes. That was, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things also that I learned in this process, Anne Spire and her boss at Random House bought the book. They did the Game of Thrones books, by the way.
You're hitting every like magic button.
Yeah. Well, she was an incredible collaborator. She said, look, guys, you got to pick up the pace sooner. You need to get things moving in the first part. And then she said, you need to pull this stuff about Finn out and push it to the book, to the maybe book two, book three. So like, get the reader hooked and interested in Finn's backstory, but don't spill the beans. Cause you know, having read the book, there's certain things that are left out of Finn's backstory. You're like, shit, I really want to know like what happened in his childhood that's influencing this kind of behavior. So we kind of have a plan to deal with that in book three, to kind of fill in that, the rest of Finn's backstory, to kind of keep readers on their toes and give them a reason to, you know, give them something to look forward to.
Yeah, no, I like that. And that's, again, similar to a lot of these other, like Jason Bourne is a great example where his backstory is unraveled through, I believe, about five different movies. Like, you get more, even in the movie he doesn't appear, you get more of his backstory. You know, but it's interesting that Anne, your editor, said move some of the action closer to the front, because yeah, you start off with some backstory about the Abraham Lincoln, which was interesting, and it kind of the issues with women and things like that, and this character, the character Monica, and Finn is just sort of arriving, like he's in there, and after, you know, a couple of these, again, short chapters. But you know, some books start off, like some John Grisham books might start off where someone is killed in the first two pages, and that sets the scene. So yeah. Did you debate starting with Finn? And again, he's there early enough. Like, you didn't start with Finn, but
when I first wrote the first draft, I started immediately with the murder scene. Like, but we realized that there wasn't enough backstory. Because part of, as you know, writing any piece of work, you have to have a complete plot mountain, right? You need background, conflict, rising action, resolution. And if you're missing any of those things, you have an incomplete narrative. And we've all watched the movies or read those crappy articles or books where we're like, really, this isn't going anywhere. Like, is it going to end? Like, so, you know, we realized we had to provide some background, especially for somebody that's not familiar with the aircraft carrier environment. I couldn't jump right into the scene on the outside of the ship, sponson and the killer kind of going to town on his victim, or her victim.
What about Lo? Like, maybe, I mean, the way you did it was perfect. This is not anything. I always just think about these choices, and I'm always amazed and you made very good choices. So I always am just curious about the process. Like, you know, Finn has this backstory where he's a little bit shamed, right? So he's on the Abraham Lincoln for a reason. Did you think about starting with that, or him kind of approaching the Abraham Lincoln, or?
You know what? It really was a case where, you know, we decided to push the murder scene out, and we wanted to tell the story of Monica. Monica is a very powerful character. She shows up in the other books as well. So we want, and look, it's part of me writing this book was portraying like the reality of military life. Like, it's mixed race, it's mixed sex, it's this mash of people together working together doing their jobs, and we have very strong characters, you know, across gender, sexual preference, the whole thing. And it was important for me. I wanted to kind of show people that, look, Monica's, I think, a great lead-in character. We wanted to build some background leading into the aircraft carrier. But look, book two, Cold Fear, the first scene, which is at the end of the book, we give a chapter at the end of the book, kind of a sneak peek. It starts off right away, this woman running barefoot in Iceland with a gown, and she slips herself into the pond. And the next morning, some girl sees this woman staring up at her frozen, dead and frozen in this pond in Reykjavik, Iceland. That's a hook, man. Like, you're like, holy shit. Like, what's, I want to know, like, what just happened? You know? So, you know, I do like those early, just grab them with something, you know, pretty shocking, and where they become very, reader becomes very inquisitive. Cause that, I think, important to hook them.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, I, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I was just talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
I'm always fascinated with the twist. Every good thriller or even every good genre novel needs a twist, something unexpected in the middle that you just didn't, the reader didn't see coming. But I always feel like it's hard to fool the reader. The reader is not stupid. So what were you thinking of when it comes to how to write a twist, or what was John thinking of?
You know, and look, I want to give credit to John. John is a super interesting guy. He was a professional musician. He played the cello. He composed music. I think his dad was also a composer. So he's great at kind of building tempo, that like a song, right? Where you're slowly kind of building up to something and then boom, you take it down a notch. But to answer your question, I think our goal was to go very deep into each character to make them, even the flawed ones are I think a little bit likable, build out this complex environment. And look, it's a massive ship, all this stuff going on. And I think we do a pretty good job of that. And I got John on the ship. I got him a pass to go on the Abraham Lincoln. He got a full tour because I thought there's no way he can understand this without being on this like massive carrier, and he actually got on the Lincoln itself. So that I think was an important part. But you know, we have a ton of interesting characters mashed together, and I love the scene where, or the chapter where they're talking about the suspects, and they're like, "Yeah, we've got it down to like, you know, 3,940." They're like, holy shit, like that's like a list of possible people that could have done this based on their like work routine and their hours and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, it's not like that game Clue, right, where you have 5 people. You have all sorts of like scenarios and probability, and I think that helped us create this situation where readers were kind of guessing, like, because it could have been anybody, right? It could have been someone we didn't even talk about the entire story that could have just like appeared at the end. But I do like, you know, we get people very familiar with who it is, and it's a very big kind of reveal at the end. So I think we did a good job. And to be honest, like Brad Thor, Lee Child, these guys went out of their way to give us not only amazing quotes, but wrote us separately and said, guys, you did a great freaking job here. And I'll tell you this, writing in the sealed nonfiction category, it's dog eat dog, man. Like nobody wants to help you cooperate. It's like everybody's like fighting for the top, right? Top seal book. This is a very cool thing to kind of get into this thriller genre and have the other writers embrace us and really help us out. That was a huge surprise to me as well.
How did you get introduced to all of them?
I mean, it's having a good network, as you know, through our editor, reaching out. The blue check helps, you know, on Twitter and Instagram, reaching out to these folks. I tried to get Karen Slaughter. I'm a fan of hers, but she was too busy.
Talk about the arc of the hero in a thriller. Like, what are you thinking about with the arc of the hero and when you're mapping it out? And what is specific to a thriller?
So, I mean, I can only guess talk about our book because it's the first time for me. But we felt it was important to make Finn memorable. You know, Finn, no last name. That just sticks with you. He's a very kind of flawed hero. And I think a lot of people can identify with him and like him for that because we're all flawed as humans. We all have these flaws we carry around. I mean, look at what Como's dealing with lately. I think John and I felt that we wanted to, you know, also this is a lot of based on even my own struggles, right? Like in the SEAL community with going to war, dealing with like PTSD and everything that happens there, like childhood trauma, all this stuff where like a lot of these characters, including the captain of the ship, Monica, Kennedy, Harris, the crewman, they're based on real life people that I served with.
How much was Finn based on you or your background?
I mean, John based a lot of Finn's childhood, you know, growing up in the ocean on me, but there's a lot of other stuff in there too that's not related to me. But John did draw a lot on myself and other characters. We wrote the book Among Heroes together, which is kind of a tribute to my friends that I served with that died in the war. Mm-hmm. That book was tough to write a book about your dead friends, but we did, a great job in showing like the incredible traits that each one of those guys had. So there's some of that in there as well. In Finn, I think there's a lot of Glenn Doherty, in Finn, who was a best friend of mine that died in Benghazi, Libya, rescuing the State Department guys when Ambassador Stevens got killed.
What happened to him?
He was working for the CIA, and the group, against orders, the chief of base in Benghazi for CIA didn't want to rescue or help the State Department guys. And they said, no, we're going anyway. So they went in and rescued everybody. And unfortunately, the ambassador, because they lit fire to the compound, he suffocated and died. But they got everybody out and they got back to the CIA compound. Then the kind of angry mob slowly started to build outside the CIA compound, and they started lobbing mortars over, and they put a mortar right on the rooftop where Glenn was set up with a sniper position, and he was killed instantly.
Gosh.
It was fun kind of taking all this real life experience and putting it into the book, right? And some characters, the killer is like a combo of two people I actually know. So that part was fun.
How do they feel about being, you know, you didn't tell me you modeled a killer after me, but like, no, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
Do you really think I would do that?
Yeah. I would tell you this, because you're a best-selling author too. I find fiction super fun because you can just make shit up. You know, like, oh, just like give them this, you know. So it is fun.
I guess there's some points where it's good to kind of go in a direction and see where it takes you. And there's other times where you kind of have to really stick to the next beat in the plot. And there's a lot of, you know, discussion of that among fiction writers. Like I said, when I first started writing, I wrote horrible novels. Now I'm trying to write a real professionally done novel. And it's definitely, you know, after writing so many nonfiction books, it's definitely an interesting, and a lot of my nonfiction is storytelling, just as yours is. So it's interesting to kind of take that narrative nonfiction style and turn it into fiction, which many novels are. Like you said, there's many components of this book that are real. You look at like someone like Charles Bukowski or James Frey, everything they write is basically nonfiction, but they call it a novel and they change all the names. So, you know,
exactly.
Charles Bukowski more than Frey, but
our friend Kamal's book, Rebirth, right? Like that's based.
Oh yeah, Rebirth is totally a nonfiction book, but it's a novel.
Yeah,
and it's a great novel.
Yeah, it is.
So, if someone's listening to this, and let's say they have an idea, everybody always says, "Oh, I have an idea for a story. I'll let you write it and I'll cut you in." But like seriously, if someone has an idea for a story, what would be the steps they should take? And let's say they're not a writer. So let's acknowledge that writing is a skill. It's a hard skill. Takes years to learn. I want to figure out kind of the skip the line version of this. Like, what could someone do like you to write a novel and maybe even turn into a best-selling novel and a TV series and everything?
So, look, I think it's a good point that you bring up because, like, some people are great storytellers, but they're not good writers. So if you're a great storyteller, you just have to find a collaborator. And there are groups out there. I think one of the sites like Upwork, you can find writers with really good track records that will write for fee-based, right? Like John's built a career doing that. He's very expensive now. And now I hopefully he'll transition into this full time, but he was getting paid lots of money to write books for people. But there are fee-based great writers, best-selling writers out there that you can, you know, pay probably $15,000 to $20,000 to develop a story that you want to tell and end up with a pretty solid product. So that's one way to go about it. The thing also that I did want to mention in this book was when I talked about how it could be a leader, you could teach a leadership course. This is based off of my two experiences. I was on the Abraham Lincoln, and then I went and did a deployment as a search and rescue swimmer, helicopter crewman on the Kitty Hawk. The Kitty Hawk, when I was going to the Kitty Hawk, I'm like, great, I'm going to this. I just came off this big nuclear powered modern day aircraft carrier. Now I'm going to this like old conventional power plant. It's a smaller carrier and it's going to be crappy. It was way better than the Lincoln. And it was because the Lincoln or the Kitty Hawk had an amazing captain. The captain talked to everybody over we call it the 1MC. It's the like broadcast speaker for the whole ship. He would communicate with the crew. Hey guys, this is what's happening. This is our plan. We're going to go here. And this is, you know, what's going to happen with the day and the ship and all these different port calls. And the crew was happy. It was a totally better experience. And then back to the Lincoln, we had the worst accident rate in the fleet. We lost a jet and a female pilot dead at sea. We had a collision at sea. I think the captain came over the 1MC one time during the entire 6-month deployment. So this was, and I'm a huge Ayn Rand fan. And so I was like, I want to put some leadership philosophy into this novel. And I think you could teach a leadership course off Steel Fear because it's a clear example of bad leadership and the effects that it has. And the opposite, it shows some very good leadership qualities in one of the main characters, Monica, for instance.
But what's interesting though is it doesn't, like a lot of times people write a novel with the idea in mind, this is really going to be a what do you call it when it's a story? This is really going to be about leadership, but I'm going to put it in the clothing of a novel. But this doesn't feel like that. It doesn't, like, just like, you know, I've seen books written, you know, the leadership skills of Don Draper. So it analyzes every episode of Mad Men and shows how Don Draper's leadership philosophy or his philosophy of life. This doesn't feel like that. This feels like a novel, and you just happen, just like these books about The Sopranos or Don Draper, you just happen to get leadership lessons out of it. But that's interesting, though, which is that it's not about the leadership. It's about the characterization, where you saw different things in your experience as a leader or as a learner or as a trainee or a trainer or whatever, and you built that into some characters. So that's how you gave the lessons, rather than force feeding certain pieces of knowledge on some characters. So it's more just a, whatever the word is I'm searching for. It's an allegory, I think it is what it's called. So
the thing also was that the captain of the Abraham Lincoln Eagleburg, his style of leadership allowed, like, the killer is able to flourish in that environment. And so that's, you know, that's part of it for sure. In the same way that this pervert was running around on the Lincoln when I was serving, molesting women, and they never caught him. Like, it just still baffles me that, and there's no FBI on an aircraft carrier, but come on, guys, like, let's like catch this guy. And they just never caught him. And the women were terrified. So, and it was because this environment existed where the captain didn't give a shit. It was all about him.
Well, yeah, we could get into a little bit of leadership here, but like, from reading your book, it seems like there's two or three main things. One is you just like in Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, a leader needs meaning that includes the entire set of constituencies or groups that he or she is leading. So if you're an entrepreneur, for instance, your meaning needs to, and you derive your leadership from the meaning you infuse into yourself and your business. Your meaning includes the value you're delivering to customers, to your employees, to your shareholders, to your investors, and so on. And it seems like the ship's captain needs to include the people working on the ship, needs to include the United States of America because it's a military ship, needs to include the world because the United States, whether it's true or not, the United States feels that they are the police of the world, but there's different philosophies to that. So your meaning and leadership there needs to have meaning in leadership. And then the other thing I've noticed in the book, you need to communicate to people. You need to give people a reason. Not that you don't want to be best friends with everybody, but you need to show that you're just as active as they are. You don't want anyone talking behind your back saying, man, if only the captain would sweep these decks like me. Like, you don't want, that's what I call a disease. And the disease spreads really fast when people start talking about you on their smoking breaks or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And the third thing is, and this I don't know, and maybe you could help me from your experience in the military, how important is transparency for leadership? Like just telling everybody everything that's going on.
I think a level of transparency is important, but I also think there are things that, it's like you worked in big companies before. For me as a leader, sometimes there's things that I will share with my inner circle, my core department heads or top executives, that I won't share with the rest of the team because they don't need to know that. And I don't want to upset morale. And it's like two captains of a ship talking about, okay, there's this big storm coming. There is a legitimate risk. It's okay to tell the crew, hey, there's this storm, this is our plan, but maybe not tell them, like, I'm pretty fucking worried about it too. Keep that to yourself, because I think that's part of leadership. It's also, I mean, I'll tell a true story. Relatives at a winter break, I rented a house with my kids and we were skiing in Lake Tahoe. And one of my female relatives had a total breakdown, lost their shit over something my 12-year-old son said about dating, like in jest. And this person went on this like tirade and like dumping all this bullshit on my 12-year-old. And I had to like take this person aside and say, look, you can't share things to my kids like you would your friends. Like they look up to you like in a leadership position. And now you've just totally destroyed your credibility. There's things you just can't discuss with kids that age. And I think that a lot of the similarities there with leadership, there are things that you can talk to and share your concerns with people that are at maybe a top level, but you need as a leader to have that confidence and be transparent too. But there's no reason to kind of, like I said, to overshare.
It seems like there needs to be trust and transparency. So like,
yeah,
the leader is telling me what he or she feels is best for me to know. And I need to trust that whatever they're not telling me, there's a reason.
Yeah. Yeah. And
this is true in The Sopranos also. So it's true in the Mafia. Yeah. The leadership skills of Tony Soprano.
It always blows me away. And the military was a great leadership experience for me because I experienced the majority of my career great leadership, but there was times when I served under terrible leaders, and I took that with me as a lesson learned when I was a leader. Like I'm never going to publicly like shame somebody in front of a group. That's like leadership 101. If somebody has an issue, you pull them aside in private and handle it that way, not in front of a group. That's just never a good idea. I never surprises me how many people are really just terrible leaders out there, like get in these positions.
Well,
of power.
It's like anything, like 98% of anything they suck.
Like Trump, I'll be honest, like Trump is a shit leader. Like he led by fear and intimidation, and that doesn't build loyalty and trust. And you saw that, like he could never keep building this like powerful group of people. They're always coming and going because he led by intimidation, fear, yelling at people. And I mean, I just thought, I'm like, okay, there's a reason everyone flips on him the minute they leave his inner circle.
He's an interesting story because obviously that's almost
smart
an understatement.
Guy. Yeah, smart guy.
And certainly like, people are very black and white on him. Like people say, oh, he did nothing good as president. Or some people said he did everything good, as everything he did was good. But like any president, he did some good things, some bad things, yeah, some things that didn't matter. He was effective in some ways. He was effective on trade policy with China. Obviously, there was a bunch of good deals with Israel. He might not have been effective on, I don't know, other things like the vaccines and I don't know, corporate government. I think his overuse of executive orders was insane. You know, but this is getting into the nuances. But he also seemed to have a hard time giving credit to people underneath him. And that seems to be an important quality of leadership.
Exactly. And look, I agree with you. I also think the byproduct of Trump, we wouldn't have the Me Too movement. We wouldn't have had the big strides we've had with racial equality, policing, right, if it were not for Trump being this like agitator, right? And I could go down the rabbit hole there. And I'm sure a couple things I've shared already are going to get me in trouble on social media.
No, because this is just a basic fact. This is true for Millard Fillmore, John Adams, George Washington, Calvin Coolidge. This is true for every president. Some things they did were okay. Jimmy Carter, who a lot of people consider the worst president of the past 100 years, or Richard Nixon. Some things Richard Nixon did were good, and some were got us out of the Vietnam War, but he, you know, took us off. People have different opinions about taking us off the gold standard. Jimmy Carter had the, you know, the Iran hostage situation and the coal miner strike. So there was this well-known phrase, there was this malaise in the country at the time, but he also was a really good guy. We got an example to see what a really good human being would be like as president, which is relatively rare.
Yeah. But to your point earlier also about leadership, America's foreign policy is one that I've been talking about ever since I left the military in 2006. there is, I have asked many people in the Senate and Congress, what is our strategy in Afghanistan? Nobody could give me a straight answer. And when nobody knows what the hell is going on, you end up with America and Afghanistan 20 years, and now we pull out and it's a worse place than we found it. So that's the shame when, if you're running a business and nobody knows what the mission of the company is, that's a problem. And so those are problems we have now in the American government.
I mean, that same situation sort of happened in Vietnam, but it only lasted like, let's call it a little more than 10 years, 10, 11 years when there was serious military action. And you're right, Afghanistan, we are coming on 20 years. And why doesn't anybody acknowledge that we just did a really, in all of U.S. military history, have you ever seen anything like this? This is like a medieval war. This is like the 30-year war in the Middle Ages.
It's the longest fought war in American history, at least. And I think close to $1 trillion spent, lives wasted. It's really a shame. Like I served in Afghanistan for 6 months, but I had purpose behind my deployment. You mentioned Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. When I went over there, we had a very clear mission. We were to destroy the terrorist training camps. We did that, and we should have come home and left Afghanistan, but we stayed. And then it just drifted into, like, nobody knew what the hell we're doing. And then it turns into 20 years of war. And then the incentives are all out of whack, right? That I could spend hours talking about the defense companies and all the incentives and lobbying that kept us spending $1 trillion in Afghanistan. And the problem is, war is terrible. I've witnessed a lot of terrible things in my deployment, but I can sleep good at night because I had purpose behind that deployment. But after 2004, people deploying to Afghanistan had no purpose. And now they're coming back and having major issues because they can't kind of rationalize what they've seen and what they've done. And now we have this massive transition of military service members to civilian life who are dealing with serious, serious issues. And we did an article on SOFRIP. The data shows that if a veteran enters the VA system, he or she instantly becomes at higher risk of suicide. So the VA is like killing people, but that's how bad the situation at the VA is with the bureaucracy and it's just a total disaster. And I don't think it can be fixed. I think you have to just get rid of the organization and send these people to private healthcare. But yeah, we should do a podcast on foreign policy.
Yeah, I would love to. We could take like 10 different aspects of foreign policy, whether it's these various wars or whether there's kind of what we're doing in Syria or other countries or also there's countries where we aren't involved militarily, where maybe we should. We're smaller, insignificant strategic countries where there's genocides happening, where we're not involved at all. And then there's trade policy. Then there's the policy of our currency. Then there's policy about immigration. And it'd be fascinating to do a podcast like that. We should totally do it.
I would love to, because no one talks about how America created the refugee crisis in Europe. We destabilized the northern part of the Middle East with the Iraq pullout. We kicked off civil war in Syria. We saw the rise of ISIS, and now this massive flow of refugees into Europe. The EU is trending towards open border. Now it's going closed border. They're putting up fences and trying to, like, you know, yell at each other who's going to deal with the refugee issue. So, and then Libya, right? We got rid of Gaddafi and destabilized that. That's a failed state to this day ever since. And it's like, what's the point? Like, what do we do this for? You know?
Yeah. The whole Arab Spring, which seemed very kind of revolutionary and like there would be freedoms. It actually, freedom seemed to reverse, even in countries like Egypt, where the Arab Spring kind of started, just things have gotten worse and not better, or at least they haven't gotten better. I don't know if they've gotten worse, but that would be an interesting,
I'll bring my interesting thing. My Harvard Business School classmate, Mohammed, he runs a big shipping company in Egypt, but he would be a fascinating person to talk to about it.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by how much money is there at the top. Like, people talk about income inequality in the U.S., but if you're like just a friend of the president, you're going to get, I'm not saying this about your friend Mohammed, but like, yeah, Hosni Mubarak's son got the deal to pave the roads. So imagine if you get the deal to pave every road in a country and you don't have to do anything. You just give the deal to a big construction company, the Bin Laden family or whatever. Yeah. It's a, who owns a big construction company, and you take a 10% cut.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah, well, so maybe that could be the topic. Like, maybe Finn gets into corporate finance at some point. He tries to be an investment banker.
The book too, actually, we deal with, there's a very wealthy capitalist kind of bad guy in book two. We deal with a lot of this, what we're talking about now, just now in book two.
I can't wait. I can't wait. This is going to be a 30 book series. This is your Jack Reacher. I hope for your sake, because it sounds like you love it, I hope for your sake, this becomes your full career. You and John, you should do this. You should make the TV series. You know, there'll be different writers and producers for that, I'm sure, but hopefully you'll be involved, or at least you'll be involved financially. But you should just keep turning out these books. You're finding your voice. The first book is great, which is a surprise, because a lot of first books and series are not so good, and you only find out about the series on book 12 when the author finds his voice and the characters really have life infused into them. But your characters have a lot of life. They're so interesting. Finn is interesting because he's not just a carbon copy of Jason Bourne. I mean, he's Jason Bourne plus Jack Reacher plus Brandon Webb and other things. He's a really interesting character. His personality is different from the typical, you know, big moody ex-military guy who solves crimes, and the story is really well plotted. I'm so impressed, Brandon. I know you've been talking about this ever since I've known you. I've known you maybe 10 years. Ever since I've known you, you've been talking about doing this. You did it, and like how you do everything, you kicked ass, and it was thoughtful, and it was great.
Thanks.
Let me just read. I read this in the intro, but I mean, to have Lee Child say, "Sensationally good, an instant classic, maybe an instant legend." That is just great. For someone like that to say that. And then I saw so Brad Thor, who's been on the podcast a couple of times, he said, "An absolutely amazing thriller. Still fear comes in hot and never slows down. Exciting, action-packed, and twisty from stem to stern. This will be one of the hottest books of the summer." And people should know, Brad Thor doesn't need to write blurbs for people to know his name, which is a good strategy if you want people to know your name, write a lot of blurbs. Brad Thor and Lee Child are the best thriller writers on the planet. For them to read your book and say this, that's no fooling around. Like, that's really good. So congratulations on that as well.
Thank you. And it means a lot, because I have a great friend and my nonfiction editor at St. Martin's Press. But Mark, he told me not to do the book. He's like, "You're a nonfiction guy, stick to nonfiction." And it just goes to show you, like, you gotta, if you believe in something, you should pursue it, because there's a lot of naysayers out there, right? So a lot of people told me I was crazy for this.
You know what the mistake they make is? We've had a lot of conversations both on the podcast and just at dinner or whatever about writing books and writing fiction. You didn't want to be a best-selling novelist. You wanted to write this story. You wanted the process of writing this story. I think too many people are hooked on, he's just doing this because he wants to make a lot of money, or he wants to be a novelist, or have a TV series made from his books. You can't want to be something. You have to want to do something. And I really feel you wanted to do this story, not just be a novelist. And that's the distinction.
100%. And I had no intention of writing a series. It just happened. And it was because I brought this story to life with John, and now all these other doors have opened up for us. So I'm just grateful to have John as a collaborator, because he's made me a much better writer, and we've got something special. So I'm pretty excited about it.
You've written a lot of great books together too. So Well, Brandon, thanks once again for your 80th time coming on the podcast. Great book. Thanks again.
Thanks, James.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.